Welcome back to Bad Gay Movies. This is episode 185. I am, of course, your co-host, Bill. And I am very excited about today's episode because once in a while, we do have the very great pleasure and honor of having somebody who is directly involved with a bad gay movie coming onto the show to talk about their experience, which I really appreciate because they're incredibly good sports and also really generous to share their experiences with us. And I particularly love it because I love the only thing I love more than sausage is how the sausage is made. And I always want to know things about these films. You know, if they do turn out to be something that I personally don't like, is that because of good intentions gone awry, or were they dealing with a crazy director or whatever? You know, I want to know it all. So today I have Mike Justice on the show. He has been an editor on numerous films that we have covered on this show, and particularly worked on today's film, Birthday Cake, by Chad Darnell. And it was really, really nice of him, first of all, to just write and tell us how much he enjoyed the show, and then to also contribute to sharing his experiences on an episode. I'm really, really happy he did. This is our last episode for this grouping, this season, if you will, after which we will be taking a break to regroup and record some new episodes, figure out what movies we want to do and stuff. So I will not speak to you until the new year, which means I hope everyone has a very wonderful and safe holiday season, and I really hope the world in some way improves, and that we all learn to get along. Isn't that delightfully naive? Anyway, I just hope for the best, like the fool that I am. Write to us at badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. Visit us at badgaymovies.com. Follow us on the socials, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. Enjoy the show.
Someone explain to me how this works.
Well, we both ejaculate into a cup.
Oh.
And then whoever swimmer gets there first wins.
Cheers. Save room for dessert.
So the documentary we shot has been winning awards and screening all over the country. I went Fort Worth, Kansas City, Cincinnati.
We didn't get into Outfest.
Welcome to Bad Gay Movies. I am your host, Bill Antoniou, and today I am super excited to once again have the privilege of having somebody on the show who is directly involved with a film that we are talking about. And as it turns out, is directly involved with a lot of the films we've talked about, which makes me wonder why he's even willing to be here, but we're going to find out. He is an actor, writer, and filmmaker. He is the author of the novel Coasting on Pretty, which I bought and haven't read yet, but I did buy it. So enjoy that 3 cents royalty wherever you want. Don't spend it all in one place. He is the writer-director of the feature film, The Trouble with Barry. He was the editor of the BGM films Out to Kill, The Men Next Door, Bite Marks, Role Play, Pornography, a Thriller. You can follow his blog and YouTube channel, The Eerie Midnight Detective Agency. And he was most important and relevant to our purposes today. He is credited as the additional editor on today's film, Birthday Cake, by Chad Darnell. Please welcome the very gracious Mike Justice.
That was an amazing career retrospective that you just gave me.
Congratulations. I mean, I did my research, and congratulations on all that you have accomplished.
No, that was awesome. I was listening to that, and I was like, God, I've done a lot.
Well, none of us are good at patting ourselves on the back enough for the things that we have accomplished in this life. So
no. And when people ask me, what have you done? I'm like, oh, you know, it's stuff, you know, I have a blog.
You have to ask. That's the rule. If you have to ask, then it clearly hasn't accomplished
right
in the wider world. But Mike, I am thrilled to speak to you today. I'm so grateful that you reached out to us. First of all, to be kind enough to tell us that you listen to and enjoy our show, but also to be willing to talk about your experiences on I'd be curious to ask you about a number of these films, but specifically about Birthday Cake. which, as I said, you are credited as additional editor on. So before we get into anything else, please tell me what that means.
So there was an editor involved to begin with who was fired. Okay. And they had the main editor, Jason, came on, and Chad asked me if I would edit. I was like the first 25 minutes of the movie and the last 15 minutes of the movie or something like that. Because I was watching it and I was remembering all these scenes at the beginning, and then I started to remember at the end as well. So I remember, I basically did like the beginning and the end, and then Jason did the middle. So
what we ended up with is an 85-minute film. What was the length of the film when you were dealing with it? Was it significantly longer, or you're fine-tuning?
It was about the same. what it was originally, they had shot, you know, multiple cameras because it's all supposed to be done sort of faux reality TV style. And the original editor had this brilliant idea that she was just going to use one take, that she wasn't going to alternate between any of the various cameras. She was just going to pick one take from one camera. And, you know, I think she thought she was trying to convince him that, you know, she's trying to do like a Kubrick thing, but she just obviously didn't want to push a button and make a cut. And then she also kept trying to steal songs that were like clearly like beyond the scope of the film's budget to license the rights for. Like, she's like, oh, let's get this song by Washed Out and put it in there, and let's get, you know, John Mayer to sing the, you know, to do like the theme song. And they're just like, okay, we can't deal.
So then you were dealing with alternate takes when you were working on the portions that you worked on. You weren't just fine tuning what was already there.
No. I mean, I did it from scratch. So
yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, he loves coverage on this movie, especially. So it's kind of a weird bird, this movie, because it's ostensibly supposed to be, it's one of those, you know, it's like, there's, it's kind of one of my most, I really, you know, there's like two genres that I really hate, found footage horror movies and fake documentaries.
I don't even think of them as two different things, but yes, I don't disagree with you. This is the sort of thing I have patience for in a sitcom format, like Arrested Development or Modern Family.
Right.
But a whole feature where everyone's winking at the camera like that, really, I get irritated really quickly. And this worked against me in this film as well.
Yeah. And also I would forget that it was supposed to be a documentary. Like, at some point I just thought it was, you know, a sort of a verite film with handheld cameras. And then all of a sudden someone would turn to the camera and speak to him. And I'd be like, oh yeah, that's right, there's supposed to be a camera crew here.
I feel that he's not consistent with it in this movie. Particularly, I find it hard to believe, even if these characters are running their own cameras, I find it hard to believe that they're running cameras in their bedroom as they're getting ready for bed. That was asking a lot of me. In the comeback, they make a point of showing that her having cameras in her bedroom is like against her will, basically. Like, you have to kind of make it clear to me why this level of privacy is being invaded, like mention it in some way. But I don't know. I don't watch a Real Housewife show, so I don't know what levels of privacy these people are willing to give up in these things.
Yeah, that's the thing too, is I've never watched any of those reality shows. Right. I stopped watching reality shows like when, you know, Anna Nicole.
Right.
I think that was the last one I watched.
The Visit of a Small Animal. What is your background? How did you end up being a film editor in all of these movies?
You know what it was I was just an independent little experimental video editor, kind of a Final Cut guru. And I guess you could say I was discovered by David Kittredge, who made Pornography a Thriller, and asked me if I wanted to co-edit his incredibly strange, sort of underwritten Brian De Palma, David Lynch ripoff. And I was like, yeah, because I mean, I just like anything that, you know, I just didn't want to do any, you know, I didn't want to do any mockish, I didn't want to do any of these, like, you know, I went to summer camp and made out with a straight boy. Right. And now I'm, so if it's like just some weird, you know, thriller about porn, I'm like, okay,
it swings big. That movie definitely swings big. And I actually do admire it for it. I just don't know that there's much in the final result, but yeah.
No. But then, so I mean, I think with the possible exception of, you know, I hope that I steered clear of the modeling stuff, you know, with the possible exception of Rob Williams, which I guess is probably like 80% of what I've done. So maybe not with that. That was not an exception. But
well, what's the experience of editing movies like that? Like, do you care whether or not you like them? And if you think they're good, that's fine. I'm curious about like... how does that, I mean, I don't know much about film editing other than the actual, you know, the craft of it, but
it's like being a nanny.
Okay.
You know how, when you're a teenager, you find your own parents really exhausting and embarrassing, but you don't mind your friend's parents.
Right.
Like the way I feel about the movies I edit is that I kind of don't really notice their flaws because they're not my kids.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, sure. You know, if there's anything wrong with you, they can blame your dad. They'll blame your mom.
So. And it's because also that you like the director.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only movie I remember Out to Kill, I remember I kind of had a particularly hard time with just because it was really kind of pushed the limits of it was just like, you know, like one of the characters, I think he like inherits a loft. He's, yeah, you know, and the lady's like, oh yeah, you know, you're his fourth cousin twice removed. And I'm like, right, you know how many people would have to die for you to inherit something from your fourth cousin?
Are there arguments with the director when you're trying to point out that like a certain cut that he wants is simply going to make the movie not make sense? Does that happen?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I would say there's about like a 6 minutes of pornography, a thriller, and okay, you'd be surprised it's only 6 minutes, but uh-huh, where anytime it comes on, I just have to like text or look away or pretend it doesn't exist because I begged him to cut it. I just said, this is just some booga booga nonsense. You are just, yeah, pulling stuff out of your ass and trying to be just, you know, just because you think that interesting things are often mysterious and unexplainable, you just throw in a bunch of mysterious and unexplainable stuff and think it's interesting. And he's, yeah, just like,
and ultimately, I mean, they're the director, so they have the final decision, but like, what is, do you have like a policy basically that you're only going to fight to a certain point and then just say, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of the reason why I got the jobs I did, to be perfectly honest, is just because I wasn't charging a lot of money. Okay. And also just because I was pretty easy to work with. I mean, at the end of the day, it wasn't, you know, there's a lot of editors that would be like, you know, my reputation's on the line, like I can't have this. And I'm like, at the end of the day, I'm just like, okay, sure, what, push button, here you go. Right. Oh, you want to use this incredibly bad take where the guy's looking directly into the camera because there's the other takes all have like a weird shirt in the background that you think people will call you out on continuity errors. Okay, we'll use the bad performance because, you know, that's more important than a shirt in hanging on the lamp or whatever. So, just at some point I just give up because I'm like, it's your kid. Like, I'm just the nanny.
And then are you working on your writing and then getting your feature film together while you're editing these other movies?
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was doing pre-production on The Trouble with Barry when I was editing The Men Next Door.
Okay. One of our favorites.
The Men Next Door. So I can't tell you, I got to tell you why I loved your show so much is because it was 2020 and I was working in an office by myself. Everyone else was home for the pandemic and I was the only one sort of brave enough to leave and actually go down there and refill the copy machine and do all that stuff. And then I just started listening to your podcast and going back, and it's kind of a case of like, when you're raising the child, you know that there's something wrong with it, but you don't really know exactly what's wrong with it.
Right.
And then when I heard other people talking, like when you guys were like getting, I was like, oh my God, you're right. Oh yes. Oh, I hated that. There were so many times when I was listening to your episodes where you would point out, you would talk about how ridiculous something was or how you hated something or how you thought that. And I was like, I wish you were right here. Cause I'd be like, I know. That's exactly how I felt. I completely forgot about it.
That's nice. And that's why it's such a treat to have you on today to talk. I mean, we do like to think that we aren't just, and I've said this many times before, we like to think that we're not just out to shit on things and that we are actually like interested in really talking about the mechanics of why something doesn't work and the way in which we think it should work. Because, you know, I watch a lot of movies, Dan watches a lot of movies, and so does Mike, and we kind of know what we're talking about. So we're not just bitchy gay men, but that is part of the fun too. And, you know, in my experience of LGBT film festivals is that's always kind of part of the fun too. So I'm really glad that you take it in that spirit and that, you know, that you're not bent out of shape about the way we talk about your children, because, you know, the intention really is not to actually be cruel.
No. I mean, the only thing that I don't like is when people just have really sort of baseless, like, basic criticisms. Like, they'll be like, oh my God, it's low budget.
Right.
Oh my God, the guy doesn't show his dick. And I'm like,
right. Yeah, no, it's important to us to go beyond just saying it sucks. We can't just say it sucks. We have to have a reason why. We have to talk about why.
Yeah, exactly. And you also know that, like, a lack of money isn't in and of itself a character flaw. It's a lack of being resourceful enough to, like, work around that is the character flaw, I guess.
Yeah. And I also always say, and, like, this is not just me backtracking to seem nicer, it really is an accomplishment to finish things. I mean, I know this for myself as an artist who struggles to finish things. It really is amazing to get something made, to get it done, and to put it out there. If you want to pat yourself on the back for that, whether or not I like your product or not, like, you are, I'm all there. I'm there for that. You know, I think that's great.
Yeah. There's a particularly heinous review of The Trouble with Barry on Letterboxd. And when I read it, I'm just like rolling up my, you know, proverbial sleeves, like, let me at him. And then I looked at the guy's profile and he said something like, he was like, this is my star system. One star. You made a movie. You're awesome. I'm so glad that you've completed that. And then all the way up to 5 stars was like the best. And I'm like, the worst he said was congratulations for completing a movie. Okay. And I'm not mad at him.
Yeah. I mean, my feeling for myself whenever I've like written a play is that you have paid me a compliment by giving me your time and your attention. Everything beyond that is your business and none of mine.
You know? Did you write that review?
I did not, no. I would never say one star is you finished a movie, it's awesome. I would never say anything quite that cheeky. Are you happy with The Trouble with Barry? Were you pleased with the result of that film?
Yeah. I mean, it turned out a lot different than I thought. That's how movies are. Like anything else, I really actually set out to create a conventionally entertaining movie, and it just ended up being so the thing about being an editor is that I'm so used to sort of saving things in the cutting room and taking, like, you know, directors will be like, oh, we lost a day's footage, and I'll be like, I'll cut around it, let's make a montage out of this, let's put this together. And so when I was making my own movie, I was very sort of lax about things because I'm like, oh, I'll fix it later, I'll just get stoned and I'll edit it and it'll be brilliant. And so that's the way it turned out. I'm totally happy with it, but I mean, it is. It has the production values of a web series, and I'm really glad it's on the streaming services like Tubi and stuff. But people, you know, I mean, I've seen it like in theaters before, like in like film festivals, and it was just you can see the seams. You know what I mean? Like when something's that low budget, I'm like,
Well. I haven't had a chance to check it out, but I will.
It's a bad gay movie.
Oh, okay. Well, then we might just have you back in the future.
I just want to hear you guys. You guys talk about it when I'm not here, and I'll just have my finger on like the pause button just in case I start getting upset.
All right. So in terms of Birthday Cake, you're also credited as appearing as a guy named Mike in the film. And I promise you, I looked, but I must have forgotten to look when you were on screen.
It's a voice behind the camera. So I'm supposed to be the director of the documentary.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So were you on the set all the time?
I actually wasn't for this one very much because I was also, that was also while I was making The Trouble with Barry.
Oh, okay.
So Chad was like, Birthday Cakes began life as a short film called Groom's Cake.
Right.
And Birthday Cake is like the feature sort of sequel to that. And I was there for all of Groom's Cake. And then when he asked if I wanted to be, how involved I wanted to be with Birthday Cake, I was like, I'm making a movie of my own. And I was basically the same thing. So what it was like was that Chad just had all these actor friends because he had been a casting guy for years. And so he just called in like every favor he could and just wrote random parts for people. And
that's random sort of is a word. Random is a word we can say for this movie. Yeah.
Well, I was watching it again last night and I was like, what's the whole purpose of like that British guy?
What's the whole purpose of this movie? I actually don't mean that in a mean way. What I wrote down, what is this movie about? Because I really don't know what this movie is about.
Well, so it was kind of like, I'm not really sure either because, you know, Chad never really struck me as a particularly like family oriented man or somebody who really he never talked about gay marriage or adoption or anything. And then when he sat down to make these movies, he's like, we're going to make these movies about gay marriage and adoption. And I was like, right. Really? I thought you just wanted, shouldn't we just be making movies about like random single Angelinos being like neurotic and dysfunctional with each other?
So what's his, before I get into talking about this movie, tell me about Chad Darnell. I knew nothing about him before I watched this film. I don't know what his deal is. So you mentioned that he worked in casting, so that sheds a lot of light on what's going on in this film.
Yeah, and he's an actor too, which I didn't really know when I was working on these movies with him. It was only subsequently he was cast in like sort of various kind of gay plays, like Hedwig and... something else. You know those ones that are like, you're always kind of hearing about it. It'll be like,
Danny like Take Me Out or...
Yeah, and it'll be like, with Danny Pintaro's in a touring production or something.
Nonsense. Yeah.
Yeah. So so Chad did casting, and everybody in the movie is a friend of his, people that he cast in movies, people he called in favors from. Also, he was going to a church in Hollywood. I forget the name of it, but it's this kind of liberal, gay-friendly church. It's like Scientology, but without the Scientology. Like, everybody who goes there is sort of kind of a reality star or a soap star or something like that. And so he knew a lot of people from he knew a lot of people from church. That's how he cast this movie.
So interesting. So my issue when I say what is this movie about, the reason is that, like, I understand that the action is centered around what is ostensibly a documentary that they're making about having adopted a little girl and being getting ready for her birthday party. Mm-hmm. But there's no beginning, middle, and end, basically. He says something, he has that quote at the end where she taught him that the important things about a story is the beginning and the end matter, and the rest is just what gets you there. But the beginning and the end of this movie are also matter that gets you maybe somewhere, which is that, like, nobody wants anything. There are little fires that he has to put out throughout. Like, there's always things that pop up. And if you wanted to tell me that he was interested in this kind of sort of, like, Jacques Tati level of creating little moments of mayhem that then work out in the way they do, then fine, because I can see the makings of somebody who could become a really, really brilliant sort of tableau artist, not a tableau artist, but like a creator of these like seemingly spontaneous situations. There are a lot of things in this movie that are actually genuinely very funny. There's a lot of very good editing, Mike, I'm not going to lie, where the humor really works, the rhythm of the humor really works, and this is something that is usually a problem in BGMs. There's a lot of great chemistry with actors. When we get to Helen Shaver having what feels like a 25-minute dramatic monologue about having abandoned and then, recovered her feeling for her gay son. I mean, we're clearly dealing with an actor who's a caliber above everybody else around her. The pride of St. Thomas, Ontario, I will also say, the great Helen Shaver. But I also don't know why that's in there, because I don't get the feeling from the beginning of the movie that he's looking to solve this rift with his family. And it doesn't seem like there is a genuine issue between him and his husband about throwing this birthday party, other than just the little things that pop up everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I think so his character is just supposed to be neurotic and fatalistic, and and the actor boyfriend is just supposed to be sort of a little bit easier going, albeit I guess more sort of self-centered or something. So he's in the first movie, it was like, they went to go get flowers, but the florist caught on fire. And then the boyfriend drugged Chad Darnell. What's Chad's name in the movie?
It's Daniel.
Daniel, yes.
Steve, yeah.
And what's the other one? Okay.
Steve is Rib Hillis.
Right. Rib. Okay. Rib. So Steve drugged Daniel, but to knock him out so that when the adoption woman comes over, that, he doesn't embarrass him, but he's still awake and embarrasses him. I don't know. So that was what I think was going on there.
Like an overarching narrative, I guess, is what I mean to say, which is that you set up like you tie a knot at the beginning and then you have to untie it by the end. I'm constantly waiting. I'm sitting through this movie waiting for the central premise.
They kind of tried to shoehorn that in at the end. So at the very end, he's like, a family is what you make it. And I was Was that what it was about? Okay. Really what this movie was about was that he just had a million actor friends and wanted to put them all in a movie.
Yeah, and then that would be okay if it was maybe a little bit more committed to being that scattered. Like, if I knew from the very beginning that I was going to watch something that random, I might have not spent the movie searching for its spine, basically. Right. Because there is the setup for something great in the fact that you do have this very archetypal couple setup, which is that, yeah, he is the cynic. And then Steven is like, you know, he's a handsome soap star. So he's open hearted and he believes in everything being good because he's always been treated well by people because people want a piece of him for one reason or another. And then Daniel's been treated differently. He's been rejected by his family. He's
unconventionally attractive.
Right. Like he's that's a nice way to put it. But we could talk about his hair. I'm not going to because, you know, why be petty?
It's been cut since then.
Great. Good. Well done. But he, you know, regardless of whether or not he's attractive, which of course he is, but he's not like that kind of West Hollywood aesthetic to say that he's going to be treated like that. So he's the more cynical one. The problem with having a character, and your cat can meow all she likes, don't worry, it's not a problem.
Okay.
The problem with having a character who is the cynic, who's always like throwing in the salty lines, is that it's a fine line you have to walk between them being hilariously cynical and being an actual jerk. And I lost my patience with Daniel by the end of this film because he just spends the whole movie rejecting everything, disapproving of everything, and he doesn't actually want anything. And so I have a hard time finding any genuine sympathy for him to see the sort of the pain beneath the salty or the icy exterior because of the fact that I love the bushy tail walking in front of your camera like Jaws. Very cute cat, everyone who cannot see what I'm looking at. But yeah, so I don't find myself connecting with him because all he does is shit on everything, which is different than him seeing the sort of realistic side compared to Steven.
Yeah, no, I mean, actually, to be perfectly honest, Daniel really reminded me of an ex of mine when I was editing the movie. It was,
they should never remind you of exes. They should always remind you of currents, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that was one of the reasons why they put in that scene with Helen Shaver was just to try to lend Daniel some kind of humanity or something.
Yes.
Something. And it wasn't necessarily humanity because it just kind of was like, okay, he's really angry and now he's really upset.
But yes, except he doesn't want anything from her. That just comes out of nowhere. She just comes into his kitchen and she unloads all of that on him. Mm-hmm. But like, he just from the beginning says, ugh, I hate my mom. Like when he says, you invited my mom, and he just seems mad about it. Like his mom is a drag, not necessarily like he was rejected from, you know, so again, that's not really set up. So again, she's wonderful, but it comes out of nowhere. And then she's weirdly contrasted with this ridiculous caricature of a Bible thumping sister that we have so many of these in BGM. And I feel like I'm like defending Christians when I talk about them, even though I'm not, because I grew up in that world and I'm a complete atheist, but like, If you want to talk about the ridiculousness of religion, particularly in terms of its rejection of LGBT values, make these people real people. You don't have to make them into cartoons. She makes absolutely no sense. And I never for a second believed that either of them were her mother and her sister.
Yeah. And also, she's really oblivious, too. I mean, for somebody who is so committed to her Christian lifestyle and denouncing gays and alternative people, she shows up at this party and there's this like flamey guy hanging out with a lesbian and she's like, oh, are you two together? And
right,
like, as if she's never turned on a television. Is hope springing eternal, or is she just oblivious, or is she just antagonizing them, or what?
Yeah, or make it clear to me that they really come from a really one horse town to say that she's just never experienced culture outside of her own world. But I still find that hard to believe because everyone has the internet in 2013 or whatever this movie is made.
Yeah, and exactly. And it's like, if you were from a one horse town and you were super Christian, I don't think you would be that. She seems to know a lot about these alternate lifestyles.
Right. So, well, and I thought that they were going to reveal some kind of hypocrisy in that. Like she was going to be a lesbian by the end of the movie.
Well, she's a vegan, remember?
Oh, right.
Yeah. I think that was her, like her, you know, and those are those little bits that you can tell, like, it's, you know, you know, actors, right? Mm-hmm. And they always want to have like, I need something to make me human. I need something, I need something to contrast. So she was probably like, pulled him aside and she's like, you know what? I really want my character to be a vegan. I think that would really add a lot of layers to it.
But like, then okay. She should have something to say about it that makes her warm up a little bit. You know, she says that in the same offhanded manner that she says everything. In real life, Christians don't go around actually judging people. I know we think they do because we see people holding signs at Pride and whatever, because those people are psychopaths. But in real life, when you're actually just at a party, a person who's a very conservative Christian just keeps their thoughts to themselves. This is always my experience of these people because, again, I grew up with these people. I remember my sister telling a woman from our church how she and her boyfriend were living together because they didn't feel like getting married. And the woman's eyes just like faded into the distance and she looked at the wall. You know, she didn't respond to anything. She didn't, you know, and I could see all the judgment happening in her mind, but she didn't say it because that's how sane people behave.
Right. You know? It's the same thing. So it's like in these really sort of aggressively, you know, alternative films, they'll always have these, you know, Christian caricatures. Right. And it's the same thing when you would watch something like, I'm trying to think of like the flip side to a gay movie would be something like, I don't know, a sitcom like Reba or something, you know, that's very much, you know, marketed towards, you know, the Bible Belt. And they would have some character on there who's like a hippie, you know, vegan who reads, you know, tarot cards and is constantly lecturing everyone about, you know, fossil fuels or something in this really like obnoxious, like clueless way. So, that's where I think those characters are from. And then also I think a lot of people just have like really obnoxious Christian relatives that they wish that they could argue with or who they wish would just come out and say these things so that they could, you know, so this is all wish.
Deliver it back to them.
Yeah. It's just wish fulfillment to have like these.
Well, of course it is. He's got like a hot straight guy as his husband. This is exactly how I write plays as well, Mike, which is that I always cast very handsome men. I write myself a very happy husband and then I cast a ridiculously handsome man in the role. I will say though, we've had a lot of like straight soap guys play gay men in our BGMs and Rib Hillis does a more than decent job. He's actually quite convincing, not just as a gay man, but he's convincing as someone who is happily married to that guy.
Yeah. Well, he's a Scorpio. So
he's got
some undercurrents there. Ribs were very gay friendly and everything, so and
he's also a model, which means he's been smacking men's hands away for much of his career, so at this point it's you beat him or join him.
I mean, I don't know anything about his past. I would bet that he wasn't an athlete in school or wasn't like the most, you know what I mean? Like he probably was into like theater arts or something. Or because you know, he was so pretty that I'm sure somebody was like, be in the play.
Right.
You know, and then so he's been around gay people forever.
Well, yeah, he's very California, but I looked him up and he has been married twice to women. So he's definitely straight because gay men might marry women, but only straight men leave them. So.
We were at his house for like a little like rap party thing. And he had like this, I guess it's his current wife, this like Ukrainian woman who was like just, you would not, you would have to be straight to appreciate her. She was, like bossing everyone around and yelling at people on the phone in Russian and stuff.
Amazing. Amazing. Also in the film is, the great and powerful Ryan O'Connor, who I used to love his Lady Watch podcast that he, hosted with his friend Jason. It's great to see him in this film. I had the odd rare conversation with him on Instagram. He's a really, really nice guy.
He, Chad wanted to get a movie off the ground about Chi-Chi
LaRue,
the porn guy.
Yep,
Chi-Chi LaRue. Yeah, and wanted him to play him.
That would be appropriate.
Yeah.
Chi-Chi's great. There's a great documentary about him called Sex Becomes Her that I saw at a film festival and then it never got a proper release. And it's a shame because it's a really, really, it's a really lovely portrait of, you know, who he is as a filmmaker and as a drag queen and as everything in between.
Yeah. You know, it's sad, you know, documentaries, once they play fests, if they don't get a distribution, it's like they are gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Find a bootleg copy online or something like that.
Yeah. No, it's just cause like nobody has them. And then the director usually will just be kind of, you know, bitter that nobody bought their movie and they're just like, well, fine. Then, you know, and it's like, put it on YouTube. Like,
so I guess Lee Merriweather being in this movie is also the result of his experience as a casting director, that he gets one of the classic Catwomen to be in this film as the ornery grandmother.
Right. Who just shows up and like, she's the comedy relief with Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Yeah, which in a movie that's already overwhelmed with comedy relief, I mean, I don't know that we really needed her. But of course, I'm so happy to see her, and she's so beautiful.
Well, and is she really any crazier than the other people? I mean, it's like her whole thing is that she's sort of like filterless because she has dementia, but everybody in the movie has dementia and is filterless.
For sure. Yeah, I think the opportunity he misses out on with her is that character is usually there to be the seemingly the craziest, and then at the end they have like a moment of clarity and say like the one wise thing that pulls it all together.
Yeah, you know? Like Jerry Stiller on King of Queens or something.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed seeing her, but I found that the character of Steve's mother was one of the most tonally inconsistent in this film, because she also pulls out this conservative wild card at some point that felt very random to me when she's like, we're not really a family.
Yeah, I kind of like that though, because it was really unexpected. Usually movies like this, they'll set up like these archetypes and they'll be like, this is the liberal mom, this is the conservative mom. And I loved seeing the heretofore easygoing, seemingly accepting mom just randomly turn face and turn into this bigoted bitch before our eyes, because it happens, you know, and maybe not to that degree, because this movie is, of course, very arch. But I do think, you know, there is a lot of hypocrisy with seemingly accepting liberal parents.
And, sure. Well, that's because it comes down to generations. And this is where we realize that gay movies are a lot like teen movies of the 80s, which is how they're all about how old people are out of touch and young people are the only ones who know anything right.
Right.
I guess it is a matter of degrees, though, because I feel like she goes to an extreme once she reveals herself that I wish that they had set up a little bit more effectively ahead of time. It feels like
it's kind of a betrayal to people
about how to play the character.
Yeah. And it's like, and people who've been following her character and liking her character are all of a sudden, you know, meant to like hate her. She like slaps him across the face and gets in a car and he doesn't even say goodbye. And she just can't stop with the with like putting her foot in her mouth. Like, well, it's not your real baby. You need to have a, what is she? She even lectures him about how he needs to dump Daniel and get a different boyfriend because he needs someone who like looks the part.
Yeah.
So she even insults him and says that his like husband is like not good looking enough and all this stuff.
I think it would have been more effective if she came across more like she was saying all those things by accident. You know, that sort of thing where you keep digging yourself deeper by trying to backtrack on what you're saying. While she is so like warm and easygoing, and then all of a sudden she's very confident in the things she's stating, and I think it would have been funnier and maybe more appropriate to the character. You know, I'm correcting this movie 10 years after it was made. I think it would have been more effective if it was more like things just kept accidentally falling out of her mouth and she couldn't help but say what was on her mind, you know?
Yeah. Kind of like when she was lecturing, she did that thing that I hate when people do when they suggest you should travel somewhere really expensive. You know, she's like, oh, what? You haven't been to Argentina? Like, you know, or something like that. And it's like, shut up.
Because that would also suit the flavor of comedy that we're going for here as well. Especially because I'm already having a problem with this movie being too random, and then things are getting even more random, including a scene where we cut to, so Daniel is working on a TV show that he has just gotten greenlit, which is basically a copy of Smash. They never say the name Smash, which is really funny how he keeps saying, no, it's different. It's different than that. And I wondered what Chad Darnell's experience was with trying to get a show greenlit or something that this joke keeps repeating, or if it was just something he thought was funny. I don't know.
I was, well, you know, on the set of Groom's Cake, I remember in sitting in like the waiting room. I don't know. It's like we were all on location. So we were just sitting in like these rooms in different locations and houses and like sitting around and like talking. And I remember somebody bringing up Smash and talking about Smash and going like, have you seen it? No, it's really good. And Chad was kind of like, you know, over here, like listening. I think that's where he got the whole idea, was just to talk about it.
That's interesting. So the scene where he's pulled into work, which for some, I don't know, it's like everything's happening on this one day that he's throwing a birthday party. He's pulled in because the star of this smash-like show that's supposed to be about the making of a Broadway play about Elizabeth Taylor, which stars, I forgot to write her name down, but the actress who's famous for being on V.
Diana on V.
Yeah.
Jane Badler.
I just read an interview with her in that Australian softcore magazine. What's it called? DNA. They just interviewed her because she's Australian. And And she's fabulous. And I'm sure she shot all that in one day. But she's fabulous. I wanted to find...
3 hours. It was like from 12 to 3.
And she learned that song too, right? Mm-hmm. She learned the song for this movie. So she sings a really funny AIDS song. And I thought that's a moment where you could have brought me onto Daniel's side. If it would, because he just makes stink eye at her the entire time that she's singing that song. And that's when I realized I'd had enough of him. I understand that the joke is that he accidentally sent her the song because he got high or something and wrote it in the middle of the night and sent it to her. But make me love Daniel by have him really believe in this. Like, tell me that for all that he's the cool, cynical guy at home, he's actually a real hack at work or something, and that he loves the song that he wrote and that he really wants us to love it. Give me something where I can find my way in with him, because that's also funny to laugh with him and not just have and not just be there while he's laughing at everybody else.
Yeah.
But that song is really funny.
It is really funny. And she's really funny in it. So she was sort of like, you know, I guess like the A-lister of this movie. Right. And so it was, I wouldn't say it was a closed set, but it was the whole movie was filmed with just everybody just hanging around and kind of, you know, sitting in the background.
Like, well, Helen Shaver gives that monologue in a very crowded house. She is unloading years of family drama while everyone is sleeping in every bedroom. But yeah, please go on.
So when they said that, you know, Jane Badler was going to, he's like, okay, we're going to go shoot Saturday. We're shooting Jane Badler's scene and we don't need you. And we're only taking you and you. And I had no idea what to expect. I was like, oh, she'll just have some little, you know, like when you get a famous person in your movie, she'll show up and say hello and make a joke about being a lizard person and then leave.
Right.
And then it was actually a role, like a funny part for her.
Yeah.
But it is sort of out and left. It is kind of shoehorned in to the rest of the movie, but.
Well, that's okay. Everything's shoehorned in. I mean, this was one thing that I didn't really need prep for, in terms of, cause it's not an emotional expression that comes out of nowhere. It's just information on Daniel's character. But again, I feel that he could have used that as an opportunity to make us soften up to him a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably where like a director who isn't the actor would come in handy.
Right.
Because, you know, the thing is, when you're directing yourself, you know, it's not that you're not good at it or whatever, but it's always good as an actor to have a second set of eyes.
Yes. Although I will say that having seen many films in which it's obvious that it's just a vanity project for the director star, he avoids a lot of the worst of it compared to other ones that I've seen. Like, I know that he gives himself a hot husband and he does give himself a crying scene.
Right.
But I didn't feel that everything was a shameless excuse. It did really feel like he wanted to create something in which he was one of an ensemble of people that he also wanted to emulate. Because he lets other people have good moments.
Yeah, there was no like shirtless scene where he's applying Lubriderm for 5 minutes or whatever. Right. Have you ever seen I Do?
Have I seen I Do?
It's it's about a British gay man whose like green card expires, and so he has to marry an American woman to stay in the country.
Oh yes, we did that one. We did that a long time ago. The one with Meadow Soprano.
Yes.
Yes, we and Alicia Witt. Yeah, we did that one a long time ago.
Yeah. Anyway, you were just talking about vanity projects, but I don't know
because that's why he wrote that movie. Didn't he?
Yeah.
That guy write that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he looks good without a shirt on, so, you know, I'm glad he caught the moment on film forever, because it didn't go off.
I think he's an ex-boy band member or something. He was, like, in a British boy band. Yeah,
I think you're right. Like, the other person from Take That that no one remembered. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The one who's like, well, you know how they say that, like, Hollywood is filled with, like, the second most good-looking person in every little town because the most good-looking person is happy to just stay behind. So it's like, yeah, it's always like the second most popular boy band member who's like, I'm going to Hollywood. I'm going to make a movie.
That's so funny. The Jane Badler scene also has the great Peter Page as the TV show's director.
Yes. And I wanted to ask you this. Mm-hmm. When I was rewatching it yesterday, there's this like a I never noticed this before, but a big Canadian flag figures really prominently in that scene, like hanging in the background.
I didn't notice that.
You don't notice stuff like that, I guess. But I was like, and so I was like Googling, I'm like, is Peter Page Canadian?
No, he was not one of the Canadian members of the Queer as Folk cast, because they shot that all here, but I knew that he was from the States. He was from I believe.
So I'm trying to figure out, I'm just like, either the Canadian flag is maybe like a little, you know, gift to Helen Shaver, or it was just probably just hanging in that house and they just didn't change the...
I think so. I would find it... I mean, I know that Helen Shaver is not in the least bit ashamed of her roots, but she's lived in the States for a very, very long time. Like, I don't think that it's something she really feels the need to pound hard on. I don't think she has a giant Canadian flag in her house, is what I'm trying to tell you. In fact, I don't know any Canadians who have a giant Canadian flag in their house, unless it's at their cottage. That's the only time, and they hang it up right next to the lake.
Right, or they're on SCTV and it's a joke.
Right, correct. I did not notice that. I don't know.
I remember I love how SCTV always acted like having national pride, like a Canadian having national pride was in and of itself hilarious and unlikely.
Yes, because we are not good at, we don't have American chutzpah about that sort of thing. And we actually suffer from tall poppy syndrome. We're really not happy when other people are proud of themselves either, and we do our best to cut them down. So when one of our own makes it big on the international circuit, we're like, she thinks she's so great.
Right. I think it's like
our insecurity on them.
Well, I just remember always growing up and always just being so annoyed that Canadian movies would always try to pretend to be American, like of all the horror movies I liked, you know, the slasher movies and stuff. And I was like, I would not think Black Christmas was any less cool if it took place in Toronto instead of in Boston. Yeah,
still goes on today. Schitt's Creek never mentions anything Canadian, even though it's a almost fully Canadian cast shot in north of Toronto. It's and its humor is very Canadian,
right?
But they never make anything specific references. But you know, I guarantee you most of my friends in the States who have told me about how much they love that show would not have watched it, or it would not have been put before their eyes if it had more of a Canadian
yeah movie. I don't get it. And then when movies do wear their Canadianness on their sleeve and stuff, it's like,
it's a joke.
It's like Intersection with, you know, Richard Gere and Sharon Stone, where like every Canadian
I know
is
like Vancouver in that movie.
And they're very proudly Vancouver, but all the Canadians I know are like, thanks, Intersection, for putting us on the map.
Oh, please, you're the first person to even mention that movie in 30 years.
I know.
You just did them a huge favor.
Yeah, even Sharon Stone's like, oh yeah, I did make that.
That's a terrible film. That's a remake of a Claude Sauté film, actually.
Yeah, I mean, its whole raison d'être was, you know, Sharon Stone doesn't get naked. Don't you want to see her range?
Yeah, she has sex with him with her dress on in that movie. I think she straddles his lap.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it must be really, really hard to be an upper middle class dude with a sports car, and you have these two gorgeous women that you can't choose
I know. Isn't Lolita Davidovich his mistress in that?
And she's like fiery and red haired, and his wife is like cold but beautiful.
Grace Kelly, ice blonde.
I think him dying at the end was my favorite part. I was like,
oh,
this
spoiler would alert, Mike, careful. Someone from 1994 might not have seen this movie.
Dude, the last 5 minutes is the best part of the movie. I'm like, I just wanted to watch a movie about Sharon Stone and Lolita Davidovich being passive aggressive to each other.
Absolutely. Oh, who does? Oh my god, I miss Lolita. I think she's great.
Yeah, she's married to the guy who made Bull Durham, I think.
Yeah, Ron
so she
Shelton,
just doesn't
yeah.
yeah she just yeah. doesn't act. She's just like whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter Page also directed one of our all-time craziest BGMs that we ever covered, which was Say Uncle. That's still ranks in the pantheon of like the most outrageously bizarre, strange, awful films we've ever done.
I've heard of it. I've never seen it.
I think it's all on YouTube. Yeah.
Okay.
It has to be seen to be believed.
Okay.
I mean, ultimately, for all that this movie has a lot of fun moments, I really do feel like whatever plot it has could have been pared down to it could have been made as a pilot, and I would have gotten just as much out of it in 26 minutes as I get out of an 85 minute feature. I will say that.
Yeah. You know what it kind of reminds me of is, this is kind of a weird reference, but do you remember those Swedish Pippi Longstocking movies that came out in the 70s?
Yeah, okay. I used to love them. Yeah.
So one of them is called Pippi Goes on Board, and it's the only one that, well, it's one of them didn't have a plot. It was just episodes from a Pippi TV show that they just kind of edited together. And so it doesn't really have a beginning or a middle or an end. It just kind of starts with like Pippi and them hanging out and doing stuff. And then like she goes to school, and then she's playing in the snow, and then they go to the circus, and then she kind of goes home. That's kind of like what Birthday Cake kind of felt like to me when I rewatched it yesterday. Yeah. I was like, if somebody told me that this was 3 episodes of a TV show that had been edited together into a feature, I'd say, I believe that.
Yeah, because it's all small arcs. Again, little fires being put out. It really needed for there to be, like, if he spent the whole day getting ready for this party, but at the beginning of the movie, he thought his husband might be having an affair, and he spends the whole movie dealing with everybody else while trying to get to the bottom of that, and it's not until the end that he finally gets the answer to that question. And then you can say that that's like the one big bow of the story, and then the little ones can come out of that. You know, like, that's what it's missing, and it just makes the whole thing feel so incredibly random, and therefore much longer than it needs to be.
I definitely appreciated it, because at the time, like I said earlier, like I was like, I was so sick of seeing movies about the boy who goes to camp and kisses the straight guy.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I know that you can feel really strongly after only knowing somebody for a weekend or a week or whatever, and these vacation romances are really hot and heavy. But I'm so sick of watching these bad gay movies where somebody would meet somebody and within 3 days be like violently offended that he had, you know, you never told me you used to be married. You never told me. And it's like, you've known him for 3 days. Like, you're staying in a sex hotel. Like, you know, like, where do you get, you know, so Birthday Cake being this sort of really sort of random, like not entirely maudlin, although it does have its maudlin bits, but just sort of random and like the, you know, it's a gay and straight ensemble. It's not so, you know, like, it's not anti-straight. It's not like they have like this one character in the movie who's straight, who's like this doofus, or this fat girl who's obsessed with trying to have sex with gay men or something stupid. Like,
violent,
it just
tendencies. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, so it just kind of, I think it was like, at the time I was like impressed, because I was like, you know, they don't make enough weird gay kitchen sink movies where somebody just throws their actor friends into it. Like, this is like straight guy territory. It's like a straight guy going like, hey, let's make a party. Like, let's rip off The Hangover.
But yeah, it's like a Kevin Smith movie almost. Yeah, I know totally what you mean. And yeah, there are a lot of relationships in this movie that you're absolutely right, that really pass muster. And I would even say that I don't even find any of it maudlin, even as maudlin as it gets with Helen Shaver's big moment. I bet. Was it supposed to be longer? Is that why?
No. I mean, it was just I was just watching like people crying and having this conversation for like days and days and days. And
I just wish that I believed that she was his mom more. That relationship just didn't really convince me. And if it did, I would have been okay with that scene, even though it's way more serious than the rest of the movie, because she's such a good actress. You know, Helen Shaver's great. And also, for anyone who doesn't know, she's a really prolific director, even more than as an actor these days. She directs a lot of television. So please tell me about your career, because you've told me how this aspect of filmmaking is in your past. So what have you been doing since, Mike?
You know, nothing. So I just sort
no
of
one has nothing.
I really okay. So I was mostly active. I started working in film in 2004. I got some studio jobs. I worked on a movie called In Her Shoes.
Yes, a classic.
Curtis Hanson made
brilliant film. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I worked on his subsequent movie called Lucky You, which
the only
was
film of his that I hate.
Isn't it? What is wrong with that movie?
I don't know. It didn't work. I might have even turned it off early. I love Curtis Hanson.
Yeah.
I'm so thrilled that I assume that this means that you actually knew him and you know, in person. Truly, truly a wonderful, wonderful filmmaker. LA Confidential is one of my favorite movies of all time. I love Wonder Boys.
Wonder Boys is my heart. I love
that movie absolutely.
So much.
I'm pretty sure I went back to university because of that movie. I even enjoy 8 Mile, and I loved In Her Shoes. And then for some reason, Lucky You, there's something about it that just doesn't come off.
It was so aggressively pedestrian and not, it was just, there was something about it. It wasn't bad. It was just nothing.
Part of it is him, because Eric Bana is a remarkably handsome man, but he's not a star. He doesn't have star charisma.
He's not very charismatic at all. Yeah. He's office hot. You know, if you went to the dentist or whatever, and he's like working and you're, you know.
Yeah, he walked by me in Toronto once, and I actually found him even more handsome in person. But there's something about him. I've seen him get leads in movies where he just doesn't have that quality.
Yeah, he wasn't very good in Munich. I don't know. No. You know what he is? He's like the male Julia Ormond.
Oh, I can see that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, where it's just like,
but not.
You're, like, it's like you're so fucking pretty.
Yeah,
but they don't pop. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
So then I was doing that, and then I would just do whatever the budget dictated. So if I was working on a studio movie, I was like a PA, and then if I was working on something like, pornography, a thriller, I was like the editor and and then I made, I just did everything I wanted to do. It's like I got to have my little studio movie experience. I got to edit all these gay movies. I got to make my own movie starring all my friends. That's like my little time capsule.
Yeah.
And then, who was it? Was it Kurt Cobain who said it's better to burn out than fade away? I just kind of like, I don't know. I just did not like LA very much. Really is kind of like, it's such a cliche to say that everybody there, people are always like, oh, people in LA are so full of themselves. And it's like, it really is kind of like it is kind of like a mean girl situation where it's like, if you want to get along and be successful, you have to like jettison any humanity that you have.
Sure.
It's
a tough competition.
It's just kind of like you have to become like this kind of narcissist. And I don't mean like toxic, vile, like horrible, like abusive narcissist people, but just like, I don't know that it was, I was like, I want to keep liking movies. I want to keep loving movies. And if I continue to live here and work here, I'm not going to.
So you're in Portland now, I think you said.
Yeah.
Which is the town where people go to retire at 40. So, yeah.
Oh, wait. I know. And there's so many like my LA friends have moved here in their 40s. And they're like, oh, I'm done with that town. And it's great because they can move here and they've done enough professionally that they can get a little like click here, a little groupie group together that, come to their house for like movie nights and stuff. And they can regale them with stories about, Treat Williams or whatever. And like the rest of their life is set.
But what a wonderful thing to be able to say that you did everything you wanted to do and you didn't need more. I mean, what a great way to feel about life. I mean, you're like a Morticia Adams level of self-satisfaction in this point.
Well, I mean, I'm ignoring all the things. Like there were some things that I really wanted. I remember I really wanted to work on this movie called Infinite Polar Bear with Mark Ruffalo.
Oh, I remember that movie. Yeah, I never saw it.
And I was really, really butthurt when I couldn't get that because I wanted to be like the assistant editor or something. And then I was like, oh God, just another nail in the coffin of like my enthusiasm. And like, I never think about that movie anymore.
Well, no one saw it, so that's probably why.
I know, and it's just that title too. I'm just like, I really wanted to work on this twee-ass hipster movie, but... Yeah.
Well, I'm so thrilled about you talking about the Curtis Hanson connection. So does that mean that you met Toni Collette as well?
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's a treasure.
You know who I was really excited about? This is so stupid, but my favorite person to meet on that movie was the woman who played Toni Collette and Cameron Diaz's stepmom, Candy Azzara, because she was this character actress who was kind of ubiquitous when I was growing up. She was in Easy Money. She played Rodney Dangerfield's wife. And she was always on like every TV show. She was on Rhoda.
I know her.
And she was the star of this really awful horror spoof that I love called Pandemonium that they used to show on TV. So when I got to like the movie and she was in it, I'm like, oh my God, it's Candy Azzara.
And did she fulfill your dream? I mean, was she?
Oh yeah. No, yeah, she was. Good. Well, she's just, she's an old actress. So she's just like, oh my God, hello, how are you? She still like sends like little cards and stuff. And like,
I totally get that though. We all have this. I mean, of course I love to meet a big movie star, but there are a lot of like people you would call character actors who have a particularly special place in I met Isabelle Huppert and that was really thrilling, but like if I ever met Diana Scarwid, I would lose my mind. That's someone I think she's retired from acting now, but I'm a huge fan of her. Like that would excite me so much more than if I met like Sandra Bullock or something.
Because I think it is because it's like when we grow up with these people and they mean so much to us.
Yeah.
One of the people who I was the most starstruck by when I lived in LA was when I met Sally Kirkland. And I was just like, because it was just, I was like, oh shit, I've known who she is since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I remember my mom saying that she hated Sally Kirkland because Sally Kirkland was a slut who didn't know how to dress proper for the Oscars. Amazing. And so that means, of course, I love Sally Kirkland because she scandalized my mom.
I get the impression that Sally Kirkland is someone who like reads as crazy, whatever, but is actually like normal and nice.
You know what she is? She's actually just really, she doesn't take herself, you know, the thing is when she doesn't take herself that seriously, like right. She'll just be like, yeah. Oh yeah, I like my crazy Eastern religion and I right. like this and that. And I'm going to go on, you know, talking about how this random dude that I co-starred in the straight to video sex thriller with is a better actor than De Niro and nobody can stop me. And it's just,
She doesn't care. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's why she revolutionized the Oscar campaign with video cassettes, because she's like, I'm just going to make everyone watch this movie and give me an Oscar nomination.
Right. She kind of did like a Carol Kane thing, I think. Yeah. She just like,
She's great, though. I mean, and she's done it all. She has done straight to video sex thrillers. She's has an Oscar nomination. She was on Roseanne and she was in a couple of BGMs. We talked about her a few times on our show.
And she's kind of funny. Like I remember she was talking once. A friend of mine was her assistant and she was talking once. She was just like, oh, I need to find a movie to do. I have no money. Oh, I'm running out of money and all this stuff. And then she's like, oh, there's a big pile of mail over there that I haven't touched. Like, can you guys help me organize my mail? And like, he opens one of them and there's like a check, a royalty check from, Bruce Almighty for like $17,000 or something. And he's like, you have a check for $17,000 here and it's voided because you haven't opened the mail in a year. And she's like,
looks like we're going to have to get someone on direct deposit. That'll be the ultimate goal.
And also it's just like, you know, when like these people, they're like, I don't have any money, you know, meaning I only have $45,000 in checking. I'll have to liquidate other things.
I feel like there's a certain kind of LA actor whose idea of not having money is different from mine.
And I mean, she never has to pay for, she could go to that old folks home, you know, the SAG old folks home.
Woodlands Hills one. So Mike, I'm not going to take up too much more of your time because you have been so generous tonight and I'm so thrilled with the opportunity to talk to you. Tell me if there was anything about this movie, about Birthday Cake, that you wanted to tell me that I didn't get around to.
Just that I was wondering to, I just wanted to know your opinion about it. Cause when I watched it again, I was like, I was wondering like how bad it is.
It's pretty bad. It's not at the lowest rung. It's not a zero star. It's a two star for me, which is that like it, I can see the possibilities there. It's not a movie where we've done movies, you know, where we were wondering what these people were thinking, what they're even going for. What are they doing? Does anyone know what they're doing?
Like the Men Next Door.
That's not even the worst. That one is more like that's more like a someone who doesn't have the guts to go ahead with their porn fantasy. Like if you're gonna make a movie with such a dirty premise, just make a dirty movie or make it dirtier than what you've got. That was my issue with that movie. With this one, it's more that I'm just bored because you have the start of something and by an hour and a half later it's still the start of something. It hasn't quite gone anywhere. And that was my issue with this film, really.
Which
is that I could totally believe that this guy could turn around and make something way better next time. I don't think that he's someone that, you know, deserves to be.
You know, he was all set to produce another movie, but apparently the producer turned out to be a con man and they're writing articles about him in like the LA Times right now. I think his name is, I can't remember his name, but he's somebody who's like, if you Google like con man producer Chad Darnell, you'll find like stories about how he was trying to.
I'm not even joking when I tell you it's like if I had a nickel for every time I heard that story. It happens all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is in LA, it's like what people, even the nicest way is that people never say it's not if, it's when. So they'll be like, oh, when I make this movie, when I produce your movie, when I cast you in this, when I bring you on board, and you just have to learn to expect it not to happen. So like when people do call and when you do get hired, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, it's so hard to find people who believe in you. And so it's very easy to fall prey to a charlatan because you're so hungry for it. And I say that with complete sympathy as someone who's been in that position. Also, movie producers are like two steps away from being gangsters at their best. You know what I mean? Yeah. They always are. That's sort of, you know, you have to have the guts to handle that amount of money, which even on a small budget is a lot of money, and you have to have your ear to the ground culturally. And so it's not like a reserved old money type that's going to do that. It's someone who is who's basically been around and has like a gangsterish type of personality.
Yeah. So, it's always like some kind of nouveau riche, like somebody who made it big, like selling recliners or something.
Yeah. And it's all about like they take risks every day. They eat it for breakfast. Yeah. And so it's really easy to fall prey to a charlatan because they don't seem that different from a legitimate producer.
Well, that's how all of these movies that I worked on got produced in one way or another. It was like they were always the producer was always like a dentist. Just had all these random movies or somebody who also worked in the biz and they, you know, had like this upper middle class job, but they weren't married and didn't have kids. And they're like, I have $250,000 to pay for your movie. Do I get to go to the Outfest party and, you know, tell people I produced this for clout and bang
that seems
boys.
To be a bone of contention in this movie is that he didn't get into Outfest.
Chad told me that I think he probably is still going to do this. He wanted to have a one man show and the title was going to be "You Should Have Been Nicer to Me."
I get that vibe off of him. Sympathetically. Do these guys do these dentists who have $250,000 to sink into their friend's movie, do they get any of it back in that level of filmmaking?
No.
So I mean, like TLA picking it up to stream it or put it on DVD back in the day, you didn't get any money back from that at all?
I mean, I can't see how. I mean, the thing is, it's like you spend $200,000 on a movie and then, you know, TLA will pick it up and for like, I don't know, $15,000 and then they'll give you like, back end, which never happens.
10 cents a year.
Or they would partially produce it. Like I remember, I think like when Rob Williams really jumped the shark was when Make the Yuletide Gay, because TLA actually like co-produced that.
Right.
Like they actually had money. They didn't just make him pay for the whole thing and then buy it later. They actually gave him money. But I remember that it was like a big deal because they were like coming to the set to like view, like, what are we paying for? but it was like some dude from TLA and I'm just like, oh God, like, where's your rental car?
Interesting. Mike, this has been a real treat. I would love to have you on again in the future. So please don't go anywhere. Thank you so much for joining me today and for talking about yourself and this film. It was really educational and entertaining for me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you as always for your support of the show. Please tell our listeners where they can find you, follow you.
You can find me on Instagram. Mm-hmm. I have a handle there, The Mike Justice. I just post clips from old movies and old commercials, and I just live. I hate the era that we're living in, so I just live in nostalgia.
Yeah, we're not that different. Okay, well then I will see you there, and thank you again.
You're welcome.